The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And for these 8 years, we were building our cybersecurity infrastructure. We experienced 4 large-scale cyber attacks on our energy infrastructure. We suffered from the Apache and NotPetya, which were directed to Ukrainian financial infrastructure, but as a side effect, you know, the world losses is about, according to the State Department, is more than $10 billion.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 14th, 2022. George Dubinsky is the Deputy Minister of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. It is a ministry set up to modernize government services for Ukrainians that has taken a lead role in keeping Ukraine functioning online during the war. On Thursday morning, he joined me before a live audience at the Hewlett Foundation's Cybersecurity Grantee Convening Conference in Los Angeles. It was a wide-ranging conversation that started with what the ministry was meant to do, what role it has taken on during the war, and it covered a lot of ground. How has Ukraine remained so resilient amidst Russian kinetic and cyber attacks? Why have the Russian cyber attacks been less effective than we expected them to be? And why is the Ukrainian internet still up when so much of the power is down? It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 14th, George Dubinsky on Ukraine's cybersecurity.
I want to start by asking you about the ministry you head, which has, or deputy head, which has no analog in American life. And so I'm interested, first of all, what is the Ministry for Digital Transformation of Ukraine? And particularly, what was it before February 24th? We'll come to the role that it is playing now momentarily, but what is the ministry that you help run?
First of all, hi everyone. Hi, Benjamin. Thank you for having me today. Actually, about the ministry. The ministry was established just after the election of our president, Vladimir Zelensky, and it was just in line with his vision of the future. And even initially, the ministry, he was going to call it the Ministry of Innovations and Transformation. But after that, he decided that, you know, the digital transformation is a key combination, which is cross-cutting everywhere, and decided to call our Ministry of Digital Transformations. And actually, the key idea was to the general idea of the ministry to make the life of our people in Ukraine more comfortable, to introduce new digital technologies, to make it easier, to make it more convenient, and to help people to go to transit to future. But we have quite ambitious goals since the start. Particularly, you know, specific goals were to transform, to move all services to online governmental services. So by the 2024, we expected to move all public services to make them online, and even we had a rule: no service could exist offline if it will not exist online. Another idea was to cover 95% of infrastructure settlement with high-speed internet, and also to involve our people to digital skills, to have at least 6 million people involved in the digital skill development program, and to raise a part of our IT sector in GDP up to 10%. And let's say, you know, before this full-scale invasion started on February 24, we were quite successful. And we really created, we really covered 97% of our territory, 97% of our population with high-speed internet. And we created conditions and connected 3,000 villages with high-speed internet, 6,000 social facilities, and we covered around 97% of our territory. And we did a few quite impressive things, at least for Europe. We established such service like DIA. DIA means, in direct translation, DIA means action. But DIA is also an acronym, which means Država I Ja, so state and me. And so it exists as a mobile application, and it exists as a web service. And there we have, particularly in mobile application, we have 14 digital documents and 20 services. And in our mobile application, we have 18.3 million users. And we have web application, let's say, where we have more than 70 public services online. And we have more than 21.7 million users. And actually, you know, this kind of ecosystem where you have almost, if not everything, but very many services which government provides to the citizens. Particularly, we were first in the world, we were first country which equals the electronic passport to paper passport. We were first country in Europe which also legalized the digital driver license. And in your DIA, in your smartphone, you have everything: your passport, your COVID certificate, your driver license, your register for your card, your insurance. You can start business, you can online, you can change the business, you can ask some, you know, paper certificate of criminal record, for example. And even it was before that full-scale invasion. And after that, exactly, we added some specific applications there. So we were quite successful in that, our ministry. And beside that, we also created some conditions for IT business in Ukraine, literally a couple of weeks before the invasion. And in the middle of February, we established this, we launched the program, which is called DIA City. It's kind of electronic residency where you can register your IT company and have probably one of the most favorable regime from the point of view of taxation and legislation in the world. So it's around 5% of taxes for IT companies, very easy registration. And again, you know, we started it in a week or 2 weeks before the war. But seeing that, we have more than 300 big companies already registered in the service, and they are working and they are developing their business IT. So we are a ministry which is moving our country to the future. And for that, we have our engines of transformation. So in each ministry, we have on the level of the deputy minister or deputy of the head of the agency, we have CDTO, Chief Digital Transformation Officer, which is responsible for digitalization of processes and services in this ministry. It allows us to be the most well-connected maybe ministry in our government. And it allows us, you know, also to move our reforms through other governmental branches, let's say. So just in brief.
When the full-scale invasion happened, a lot of things changed in Ukraine. And I assume that you guys acquired some mission set that was immediately associated with the conflict. What has the role that the ministry been playing during the full-scale invasion look like in addition to the baseline mission that you were already playing?
Benjamin, you understand, you know, everything has changed. Even we are in war for 8.5 years. After the full-scale invasion, all agencies, all, you know, entities and people, you know, changed their mind, and they decided if we will not protect our country, we will not exist. So exactly, we changed also our work to help to protect and to for our country and to secure our economy. So exactly, the ministry, we were responsible for, particularly for telecommunication sector. And exactly, we started to work with telecommunication companies, particularly with SpaceX, to provide our people with spare communications because of Russians significantly ruined our telecommunication infrastructure. Also, we started to work because of on the third day of the war, Russian cruise missile hit at our central database. We started to move our registers in more safe places. And just literally once in the week before that, we adopted a law which allowed us to move the critical registers to the clouds. So we started to work with big tech companies, with our partners, and ask them to host our critical registries, which allowed us to continue to work as a country, as an economy. And so we secured our the most critical registries in Amazon, in AWS, Amazon Web Services, their clouds, and Microsoft Azure, Oracle clouds. Also, governments of other countries help us, and Polish government particularly, you know, they created specific servers for our registries. Also, we created a few, we started to work with big tech companies, and they helped us a lot. Even, you know, on the level of, we call it digital solidarity, they stopped their activities and their business with Russia. It was very important from moral point of view. It was moral support for us because of the companies based on their corporate values, which are probably the same with our values. They decided to stop operations with Russia and to stop finance Russian warfare in this case. And they provided us with many very helpful technologies which we needed during this severe, let's say, time for our history. And we on our side as well, you know, we were working. Our D application and continued to work. Literally each week or each 2 weeks, we launched a new application for people who, for internally displaced person, for example, to register them, to provide them with financial assistance. Also, we have a specific application which allowed people to take picture and to apply if their houses were destroyed by Russians, you know, they can apply for assistance and make a documentary of them. We launched a specific application which we call e-Vorok, which means e-enemy, allow people to inform about the hostile troops they see, you know, and inform about their move. It was very helpful for our armed forces as well to know what's going on. Even, you know, to counter Russian propaganda, because of Russians, they ruined the regular communication means. We launched in our D application specifically radio and television. So the person through this application can get access to some truthful sources of information, which I believe also, you know, important dimension of this work. And so many, many other things we did. And but again, you know, we are working very closely with other governments and with big business. And after that, we believe that public-private partnership and international cooperation is one of the key components of digital resilience in the big Ukraine.
So one of the amazing things watching from the outside has been the resilience of the Ukrainian internet in the face of these missile attacks. I want to bracket the issue of attacks on power supply for a moment, which I'll come back to. But it seems to me that there has been, you have these places where cities have been destroyed. I'm thinking particularly of Mariupol, and yet people are able to, or at different times have been able to communicate out of them. There has been amazing degree of connectivity given the amount of destruction. And I'm interested in how you guys have managed that. How is it that in the face of the kind of devastation, you've really kept the internet up and allowed a remarkable array of communications in and out of the country and within the country?
Yes, Benjamin, it's very important right now in the current, in the modern world, it's very important to be online, you know, and to serve online. And this is probably our war, unfortunately, is the first online war at all, because of everyone had and still have connection, and they are posting the photos, video, and they are tweeting, commenting everything they see. And you can watch this war from any point of the world. And it because of we were able to agree, and we asked Elon Musk and SpaceX Corporation for their help. Because of Russians, when they came, the first thing they are doing, they are destroying all cell towers and they are destroying optic fiber connections. So we believe that they destroyed around 25% of our telecommunication infrastructure, one of the most developed in Europe. And so they've just cut it. I believe 18 point, we have some, we counted 18.7 thousand kilometers of optic fibers. And they are ruined quarter of infrastructure. And we had to replace them. And we're thankful to SpaceX for their donation. We received the first batch directly from SpaceX. And we started to use Starlinks on our territory. After that, we received a few batches from EU countries, and we received 5,000 kits from, with support of USAID, we received 6,570 with support of Polish government. So we have right now around, with the support of the Ministry of Digital Transformation, we received around 20,000 of Starlink kits in Ukraine. In general, including other channels, according to the data from SpaceX, we have on the territory of Ukraine around 25,000 kits, Starlink kits. And it allows us to maintain and to support telecommunication in the areas where regular telecommunications fixed and mobile were ruined. And so it was essential part of our digital resilience to replace by Starlinks and regular connection and to provide people with connectivity, to provide people with mobile connection, you know, to connect cell towers or to restore cell towers to connect them with Starlinks, or to put Starlinks on vehicle and make mobile point for Wi-Fi access where people can call to their relatives and say that, oh, thank God I'm alive. really, you know, it was very important for us. And all liberalized cities like Izum, Balaklia, Kupiansk, Kharkiv region, you know, we are trying quickly, just next to the our defense units, we have our telecommunication teams, which are restoring the connection. And we believe very soon we will restore telecommunication also in Kherson.
Wow. So let's talk about the other element of resilience, which is that, you know, at the beginning of the full-scale invasion, everybody expected, at least everybody that I heard from, expected very devastating Russian cyber attacks. And those largely did not materialize. And there have been a lot of different theories about why. One of them, of course, is that actually missiles work better. And if you want to devastate Ukrainian cities, blowing things up is more effective than attacking by digital means. But another theory has been that you guys have been really effective in countering cyber attacks. And so I'm interested in your assessment of how Ukrainian cyber defense appears so much more effective than people expected it to be, and why Russian cyber warfare capability appears so much less effective than people expected it to be?
You know, it's quite, let's say, tricky question for us. We are exploring this as well. First of all, I believe the secret of success is following, you know. We are under Russian cyber attacks since 2014. And for these 8 years, we were building our cybersecurity infrastructure. We experienced 4 large-scale cyber attacks on our energy infrastructure. We suffered from the Petya and not Petya, which were directed to Ukrainian financial infrastructure, but as a side effect, you know, the world losses is about, according to the State Department, is more than $10 billion. Even according to some sources, even more. And exactly, we were building our cybersecurity. We established specific agencies, particularly under our ministry. We have a specific cybersecurity service, which is called SSCAP. We have National CERT also in this agency. In general, we have 9 subjects of cybersecurity in Ukraine. We have legislative basis for cybersecurity, and it's built on the best practices of the European Union and NATO. We have cyber strategy, and we have plan how to prevent that. We are conducting some exercises regularly, and we are working very closely with our international partners, particularly with the United States, you know, since September 2017, I remember, you know, we started U.S.-Ukraine cybersecurity dialogue. And so this cybersecurity dialogue has a few dimensions and, let's say, a few flows with different agencies, and was very helpful for us to understand and to exchange experience with our colleagues, to receive the best practices and also to host their experts and to establish a system of exchange of cyber threats intelligence. Also, we have the cybersecurity dialogue with the European Union and with bilateral dialogues with a few other countries. So we believe it's also a very important component, because of, in the current modern world, it's very difficult to reach, you know, resilience and cybersecurity for just only one country. Another dimension of that, from their side, you know, maybe the Russian cyber capabilities were maybe a little bit overestimated. like Russia overestimated their own capacity in kinetic sphere as the army, maybe they overestimated their cyber capabilities. Exactly, we've heard and we learned all activities of APT-28, APT-29, cyber nukes, and exactly they were trying to fancy cozy beers and the others, and exactly they were trying to hit our system. The first attacks started even before the full-scale invasion. They started in January, and in the middle of February, we experienced the biggest DDoS attack on our system, and it was already obvious that it was kind of preparation for the big scale invasion. They were tested, are they able to hit our critical infrastructure simultaneously with their invasion. And we saw the attempts to coordinate the cybersecurity attacks with kinetic attacks. Particularly, we had these cases in Mykolaiv region and in Dnipro regional state government. Also, they tried to hit, and few other cases. And in general, we right now, for a moment, if I'm not mistaken, we counted 1,000, more than 1,300 cyber attacks, not cyber incidents, but full-scale cyber attacks documented. So they are persistent, yes, they are trying. But probably because we were prepared, no crucial losses we have. Yes, they are trying. They are trying to hit our energy infrastructure. They are heavily trying to hit our financial infrastructure, information infrastructure, but no big losses still we have. Also, they are trying to use cyber criminals. And we saw it because of the way they are doing. They are not using such cyber weapon, which we are mostly appropriate to these state-sponsored APTs, like which are supported, we believe, by FSB, GRU, SVR, and they are coordinated from Kremlin. But also they are using cyber criminals, and they are using such nets like Killnet, for example, also to conduct their attacks. But once again, we have already kind of strong cyber security school in Ukraine, and we are working in tight, close cooperation with our partners. Maybe this is a reason.
Yeah, so one of the things we have heard a fair bit about in the United States is the role that Microsoft has played as one of the Ukrainian partners in dealing with these cyber attacks. Can you talk about to what extent is this resilience? To what extent is it a creature of industry maturity in among your partners, and to what extent is it a Ukrainian government capability?
Excellent question, and I had to mention about that. So we believe that in general concept, after the full-scale invasion, we understood that cybersecurity is very important, but it's just a part of the puzzle. We have to think about digital security wider, and we have to think about digital resilience. And we build this digital resilience together with our private, with private companies, with our partners from business. And this public-private partnership is extremely important. According to the U.S. sources, I talked to Michael Chertoff, I believe he mentioned that around 40% of this cyber sphere belongs to the private sector. We cannot ignore private sector. It's key player there. And yes, we enjoyed support of Microsoft threat intelligence team. They provided us with some information even before attacks, and they helped us to investigate such attacks, and it was also very important. Also, we work with few other companies, and maybe we can mention them, maybe right now, maybe later, with Recorded Future, with Mandia. And so we have very close cooperation. We are working with cybersecurity team of Google as well. And because of that, maybe we were able to prevent some attack. And in the future, I believe the public-private partnership is the essential point of the concept of digital resilience. It's impossible without private sector. So in this triangle, international cooperation is very important, but cooperation with tech companies is not less important. So I believe that digital resilience, we reach kind of digital resilience beyond the national borders, just because of we had such cooperation with our international partners and with private companies, which allows us, you know, to redistribute data, to receive telecommunication technologies, and to protect cybersphere as well.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I want to talk about information operations. As I said earlier, the dominance that the Ukrainian government and supporters have had in the information space, at least in the West, is overpowering. And I, you know, you mentioned that people should be able to fight this war wherever they are in the world through connectivity. And there have been a variety of very aggressive and effective, I think, information operations, the most famous of which your defense minister actually publicly acknowledged, was the NAFO community. But there have been others as well. And I'm interested in how active the Ukrainian government has been in supporting and coordinating these operations, or to what extent they are just the sort of organic expressions of individual groups of Ukrainians and their supporters, both inside and outside the country.
Benjamin, you understand that, you know, this area is quite sensitive, exactly. The same as in cyber, you know, we were trying to build our cyber defense since the war started in 2014, and we are building our information defense also all of these years. And we are focused, and we are still focused on countering disinformation, first of all. Unfortunately, information became a dimension of this war, important dimension. And this information war did not end, it did not stop during these years. And Russia is using its historical experience. You know, they just continue the experience of Soviet Union. They just changed, you know, newspapers. And they are using and they are using internet right now, social media platforms, blogs, Telegram channels, Facebook, everything to spread their disinformation. And they focus their disinformation not only in Ukraine, you know, to convince us to surrender and, you know, to give up, but also to European countries and other countries to somehow, you know, to reduce the support and the readiness to support Ukraine and to fight. They focus their disinformation efforts also on not only in, you know, and English-speaking countries. They are very heavily influence some Spanish-speaking countries, they influence in Arabic-speaking countries, the influence in Africa, India, China, Latin America, just because of they are trying to influence on the countries which are voting in the United Nations. And but it's the key component of that is that it's an extension of their own propaganda, their own, you know, brainwashing machine in Russia. And it's all, everything is based on a lie. And unfortunately, I have to say that this internal propaganda and brainwashing is unfortunately is very effective. And since the start of the war, maybe we were naive. A lot of our people, talented people in media, writers, journalists, they decided that if they will show the Russian population, Russian people, you know, grassroots people, they will show that everything Russian army is doing in Ukraine, people will, you know, race and they will stop this war, and they have some protests, inspire some protests in Russia. They make clips, they make photos, they report from the ground. Unfortunately, no way. Exactly, we have no official, let's say, pulse and sociology in Russia, but maybe they are just threatened, but it has no effect. But Russia is trying to conduct their information operation. What we did, all of these people, all of these professionals, they were just trying to show the truth, what's going on in Ukraine, and they are trying to deliver their messages to Russia and to other countries. And maybe, you know, we had some misunderstandings with social media platforms, particularly because of people, you know, they were suffering from obviously PTSD, they were under stress. And under attacks, it's very difficult to be politically correct and polite when you have missiles in your head and your shahids hitting your energy station nearby you, and you have no electricity, you have blackouts. But we are trying to explain this. Yes, we have to find a way how these people can express their feelings. I believe they have this right, but to follow some, let's say, rules in this case. I do not believe that this kind of ipso really, you know, maybe it's an attempt to deliver truth, and maybe, you know, it's our attempt to show what's going on in reality. And if you can say that our president, who is really, you know, talented person, is able to deliver his message, and you call it information operation, maybe yes, maybe it's kind of information operation in this case.
To summarize what you just said, you seem to be saying that Ukrainian information operations are most effective in Europe and the United States and the West. Russian operations have been relatively more effective in areas of the developing world, particularly, if I can add something to what you said, in areas where grain purchases are a weapon that is really deployable by the Russians, grain availability. And your operations have been least effective in Russia itself, where the visions and images of what Russia is doing in Ukraine actually don't seem to move the population very much. Is there is that a fair summary? And if so, what lessons can we draw from it? Is it basically that there are some places where, you know, you're just not going to be able to make a lot of headway in the information environment? Or is it that a different type of information approach might be more effective in these spaces? What do you learn from it?
We learn that, you know, we cannot generalize this conclusion over all population of Russia because they are different. I believe that Russia is building the Iron Curtain or rebuilding Iron Curtain around it. And, you know, just to filter all information flows inside Russia, but leave for them opportunity to influence the rest of the world. And I believe that such channels like YouTube or other communication means we have to deliver truth to Russians. It's kind of, you know, historical traditions for them, because of officially they have to follow the Kremlin's line, but unofficially somewhere on kitchens they are discussing more openly the truth, but they have to have access to this truth. So I do believe that we need to continue to deliver this truth through all existing channels. But once again, we have to be aware that we are competing with 20 plus years of brainwashing in Russia during the Putin's presidency. And so it's very difficult to convince people that, you know, the rest of the world also has right to live as they want, not as Russia wants. You know, we choose our way. Ukraine choose our way of democratic and humanitarian values. And we have right to live as we want, not as Russia wants. And so, yes, we have to convince them somehow.
All right, we're going to go to audience questions. If you have a question, please wait for the microphone to come to you before you ask it. And while the microphone is making its way around, I will ask one final question, which is, in the last several weeks since the attack on the Kerch Bridge, Russia has really gone after Ukrainian power facilities and energy infrastructure in a very aggressive fashion. How is that affecting internet resilience and digital resilience in general? Are there internet problems that are arising simply out of, as a collateral damage from attacks on power infrastructure?
First of all, you know, I would not like to connect it with attacks on Kerch Bridge or what happened in Kerch Bridge. I believe that Russia deliberately, they planned to attack our energy infrastructure before, and they were trying to do that even before that. And they will continue these attacks on our energy infrastructure. They hit it right now. In one moment, they hit it around 40% of our energy infrastructure. They are trying to do it through kinetic means and through cyber attacks right now. They are not, they have maybe not enough cruise missiles. Right now, they are using quite comparatively cheap Iranian drones, Shahids, for that. But nevertheless, exactly, it's extremely painful and it's extremely uncomfortable for our people to live in the situation of unpredictable blackouts. So in Kyiv, we particularly, you know, had sometime 3-4 interruption of electricity per day for 4 hours. So 12 hours per day, you had no electricity. It's quite difficult. And we are trying, as a Ministry of Digital Transformation, we are trying to support and to maintain our infrastructure, telecommunication infrastructure, to help our fixed internet providers and mobile providers with generators, with power packs, power banks. I can say that, you know, I contacted with Tesla and asked them to sell us Tesla power walls for those purposes, particularly, you know, and we are looking for some partners for these supplies all over Europe and the United States. And yes, definitely we have to somehow strengthen our resilience in the energy sector as well, because the energy sector is influences the telecommunication sector. And the energy sector, as you can imagine, we have quite severe winters in Ukraine. And unfortunately, we can predict that Russia will strengthen their hits to our energy infrastructure during this winter. So we have to be ready.
All right. So when the microphone comes to you, please do introduce yourself and pose your question.
Oh, hello. I'm Frédéric Douzet. I'm a professor at the French Institute of Geopolitics in Paris and the director of the Center GIOD. My question is, at the beginning of the war, the deputy prime minister of Ukraine wrote a letter to ICANN and to RIPE NCC to ask them to put sanction on internet resources for Russia. And I would like to reflect on this and explain maybe what you were trying to achieve and were there any concerns that the Russian citizens might also be cut off from the internet, facilitating brainwashing. Thank you.
You know, the question has two aspects. First of all, we want to deprive Russia all possible means which they can use as a weapon. They weaponize internet as well. And they weaponize this information sphere. And we asked companies and social media platforms to stop and to stop broadcasting state-sponsored Russian outlets, just to stop the spreading of disinformation. And the second one, you know, it's also important. If Russia behaves itself as a medieval tribe, let them live as a medieval tribe without access to modern technologies. Because of these modern technologies, they are misusing, and they're using them to create weapons against this democratic world. And we believe this model is not sustainable because of the country which in the 21st century decided, you know, to break all rules, has no right to live in this civilized world in the same life condition with the rest of the world. Maybe the general idea is that. So, and in information dimension as well, you know, to stop of Russian websites which are spreading disinformation, I believe is very important.
Thank you for your time and thanks for the address. Stéphane Dugan, the CEO of the Cyber Peace Institute. We are tracing since the invasion the cyber attacks that are deployed in the context of this conflict. And we could see so far that 65 threat actors impacted more than 22 sectors between civilian infrastructure, civilian objects. But more importantly, with a spillover in 34 countries, so way beyond the borders of Ukraine and Russia. So my question would be, did you engage with other states, the ones that are impacted by these attacks, and what is their feedback discussion when it comes to the fact that they are also impacted by attacks that are engineered in the context of the conflict?
Thank you. It's a very interesting question. First of all, Russian attacks became more targeted, let's say, comparing with NotPetya. And comparing to 2017, it's much more deliberate. But they are using the specific malware and kind of Thunderworms and you know, WhisperGate and other. We believe it's kind of cyber weapon and this malware. And exactly, we are in contact with other countries. We are exchanging information. We particularly have very close and good connections with the Department of Homeland Security and with CISA. We exchange in cyber threats. We exchange in with many other agencies, information as well as cyber threat intelligence. And to prevent such losses for them as well. But again, you know, the tactics changed, the strategy changed. They are using more phishing attacks. They're using social engineering. They are trying to you know, make shells to some particular objects, and they're using specifically prepared malware. Also, by the way, not only for the Windows-based platform, but also for servers, hardware servers running on Linux. And so we can say that Russia is working on cyber weapon and in some larger dimension, you know, it has to be prohibited like, you know, nuclear weapon. It has to be, this sphere has to be regulated. You know, it's just, internet became some toxic sphere, very dangerous. And it will be weaponized if it will not be regulated in the dimensions, it will be not well protected in this sphere. So we believe that strong international cooperation and participation in the threat intelligence exchange is very important for countries for their cybersecurity and digital resilience.
Yes, thank you very much. My question would be aiming at the refugee situation of countless millions of Ukrainian refugees all around the world, and also to what extent you see with your ministry the mandate also extending towards them, in the sense of still accessing some of the technology that you've originally meant to be using, of course, in peaceful times. Things come to mind like, are there restrictions on media use for example, Ukrainian refugee school children that would like to utilize, you know, content that is available in Ukrainian only? Are there roaming restrictions? Do they use VPNs? How is that dimension something that you have in your mind when thinking about engagement of the population that is also right now, unfortunately, outside of the country as well?
Thank you very much. Great question. You know, I mentioned DIA, the application by DIA, you know, the everything you have in your smartphone. Many people left a country on February 24th, February 25th, and you know, late February, early March, without any paper documents. Because of, say, first of all, they had everything in their phone. And they came to other countries and they were surprised that DA is not working. So right now we improve the situation and we introduce DA in English, and we are working with other countries to recognize these electronic documents in your mobile application DA as legal documents in your country. Particularly, we are working with our Polish with the government of Poland on that. And also, you know, this DA application is the what does citizenship mean? The connection between the person and the government. And to keep this connection, you know, you need somehow you need some means for that too. And we believe this DIA application is one of the tools which allows a person to stay in contact with the government, to receive their information, to receive their document, to receive their services, even, you know, outside country. We also have internally displaced people, and they also need such services. So in this case, we are providing them with information, we are providing them with services. They can register some losses, they can apply for some assistance, they can inform government and receive the papers and receive their documents and everything, you know, remotely, just using internet and using their mobile application. So we believe it was a kind of stress test for all our system. And it was kind of challenge for our ministry, but we were able to support our people, and we are working on that and quite successfully. And we decided after that maybe to propose our DIA application as a platform to other countries, particularly for European countries, and to build something the same on the full scale, full European scale. At least, you know, the application which will be universal for other countries and which allow people to move through the borders and have no slew of different applications, but have one application which allow you to have all your necessary documents in one place and all services.
My name is Brandon Pugh. I'm with the R Assured Institute, a nonpartisan think tank in Washington, D.C. My question pertains to data privacy and data security. We saw a lot of reports in the U.S. that Russia was amassing information on members of the Ukrainian military, as well as intelligence professionals, and trying to exploit that, not only for disinformation, but also for physical harm. Has your office done anything to try to protect that information? And then if so, is there any best practices kind of going forward? Because I think that trend will probably continue in the military space.
Good question. And painful question, unfortunately. You know, Russia is trying to attack. So these cyber attacks, as I mentioned before, they aimed at our information infrastructure as well. They were trying to receive access to our personal data of our citizens, particularly, you know, to false, to falsificate the polls in the Luhansk, Donetsk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia Oblast. And also exactly they are trying to get info and personal data of our soldiers, of our officers, and for people who are defending our country. And they are working on that quite professionally. Yes, you cannot exclude that they were successful in a few cases. In particular, I know that Killnet is working on that very actively. And they even, reached the Instagram of General Zaluzhny, Chief of Staff of Ukraine. We are trying to protect them, exactly. And so we have some rules internally in Ukraine, and we asking our people not to take photos of, to take pictures of the faces and the move of military technique, particularly because of everything which is posted in social media, Russians are monitoring very closely. And so for that purposes, we have to be very careful, and we are working on kind of cyber and information hygiene. So we started it before the war because of it was important, and we are trying to educate our people, to teach them how to conduct themselves in this situation, in this war, how to protect their personal data, what to do with their smartphone, how to protect the data from their smartphone, from the breach, how to change their passwords and everything. And also in information sphere, you know, not to, to enter their personal data on some suspicious websites and so on. So yes, we are working and we are trying to protect them, but almost, you know, we are trying to do that successfully, even we had some breaches.
We are going to leave it there. Please join me in saying "Дякую" to and "Слава Україні" to our guest. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Benjamin. Слава Україні, героям слава. Thank you very much for your invitation, and thank you for having me. Peace and prosperity to your country.
We will be thinking of you and Ukrainian forces in the days and months to come.
Thank you very much. We are doing our best, not only for ourselves, but we believe also for the rest of the democratic world. Thank you very much. Thank you for your support.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, and this time it is produced in cooperation with the Hewlett Foundation. Thanks to Kelly Bourne and all the Hewlett folks for making this audio available and inviting me to interview Minister Dubinsky. Hey folks, you should do your part to support the Lawfare Podcast. Become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.